of this talk of regime change is totally outside the framework of the United Nations and outside the frame of international law.
The time has come for the Security Council to fulfill its obligations and enforce its resolutions.
There have been lawyers organized in Britain who, in fact, have already served notice on Prime Minister Blair.
The whole war was actually quite extensively planned long before the September 11 attacks, and then we really start to think that there is something dodgy about the official narrative.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, March 13th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. As the Bush administration's March 17th deadline approaches, efforts are underway to prosecute Tony Blair and impeach President Bush if the two move ahead with plans to invade Iraq. A group of British lawyers have served notice on British Prime Minister Tony Blair and his cabinet members that if he joins forces with the U.S. and launches an attack on Iraq, they will prepare a brief to be filed with the International Criminal Court at The Hague, insisting on their prosecution. Francis Boyle is a professor of international law at the University of Law in Champaign. He has a little experience with bringing up world leaders before the ICC. He led the battle that brought Slobodan Milosevic to trial in The Hague. Boyle says Blair is well aware of the court and its jurisdiction.
This consideration weighs quite heavily on Prime Minister Blair. He's a lawyer, his wife's a lawyer. And one of the reasons he's demanding from the Bush Jr. administration that there be this second Security Council resolution is to give him some type of legal cover from a war crimes prosecution.
What international laws would Blair likely be breaking by launching this war without that second resolution? And for that matter, what about Bush?
Right. The problem with Bush Jr. is that the United States is not a party to the statute of the International Criminal Court. And in fact, that is exactly why the Bush Jr. administration has done everything humanly possible to sabotage the International Criminal Court. As you know, President Clinton signed it on the way out the door. And the moment the Bush people came in, they've tried to sabotage this court, and it has been reported, even in the New York Times, that one of the reasons they're going all out to sabotage it is their fear that the highest-level civilian officials in the United States government could somehow be prosecuted as well. But the difference with Tony Blair is that Britain is a party to the ICC statute. So you're not going to have any jurisdictional problems along those lines.
And so what specific international law would he be breaking?
Well, at this time, the ICC does not yet have jurisdiction to prosecute the crime of aggression. It will once there is a definition agreed upon. But it would be war crimes, crimes against humanity, arguably genocide, grave breaches of the Fourth Geneva Convention, violations of the laws and customs of warfare. If you look at the scenarios planned, this so-called shock and awe strategy, it sounds like a conventional version of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Yeah, but wait a minute. They can try him or prosecute him for war crimes and genocide and violation of the Geneva Convention even before the war begins?
Well, it is also possible to deal with what we law professors call inchoate crimes, planning, preparing, conspiring, and aiding and abetting. So in theory, that might be possible. I do not know. You know, I'm not involved in this effort. They have very competent lawyers over in Britain who, you know, I've been in contact with lawyers up in Canada, Norway, Ireland, and a few other countries on legal initiatives here. I don't recall dealing with the British lawyers. I don't know if they plan to submit something before or after the war starts, but clearly these inchoate crimes, too, can be prosecuted. Conspiracy, aiding and abetting, incitement, and attempt.
Mm-hmm. And so what actual power does the International Criminal Court have? Couldn't Blair or Bush, for that matter, just basically ignore the rulings if they chose to?
Well, they would have to live in a cave for the rest of their life if that's what they're going to do. If there is, judgment entered against them, like Slobodan Milosevic, they could be spending the rest of their lives in jail or else as fugitives from justice. There is universality of jurisdiction with respect to war criminals. So any country that they traveled to would be under an obligation to apprehend them and turn them over. So again, Bush would probably be stuck here to the United States for the rest of his life. Blair, I'm not sure where he would go if Britain is a party and there's a judgment against him.
Hmm.
They would be obliged to turn him over.
Hmm. Well, this sounds quite serious. If, in fact, the court were able to, there's some legal process that would require, that would have to be met, or some standard, legal standard that would have to be met before they could actually bring these charges.
That is correct. I myself filed charges with the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia with respect to the massacre at Srebrenica. And as a result of those charges, we convinced Carlo Del Ponte to indict Milosevic for every crime in the book for what he did in Bosnia. Up until then, he was unindicted. So what would happen here, they would put together the complaint. They would then file it with the prosecutor. The prosecutor has not yet been appointed, but it could be Carlo Del Ponte. I've worked with her. I have great admiration and respect for her, and she is very tough. And then she would have to launch her own investigation into these allegations, both the facts and the law. And then if she decides to bring an indictment, that would have to be brought before a special tribunal of judges to look into it, to confirm it, and to make sure that there is reasonable basis to prosecute. So this would just be the beginning of the process. But let me say this. As a result of my efforts, I got Slobodan Milosevic indicted for what he did in Bosnia, for killing a quarter of a million people and for raping 20,000 women. And he is now on trial in The Hague for what he did in Kosovo, Croatia, and Bosnia, and I got him indicted for Bosnia.
Mm. And I think the key word here is what he did. And this whole scenario rests upon something that is intended to happen if in fact, this is a strategy to try and prevent war, prevent half a million or so people from being, Iraqis from being killed.
Well, I don't know what their strategy is. As I said, I'm not part of their group. They have not asked me for their advice. I guess you would have to ask them. But clearly, here in the United States, we're doing everything humanly possible to prevent this war. We now have a draft bill of impeachment there in circulation in Washington, D.C., against President Bush. You can read about it in roll call, today's roll call.
Mm-hmm.
We had a two-hour meeting in Washington on Tuesday. Ramsey Clark and I presented the strongest argument possible for the immediate introduction of a bill of impeachment into the House in order to prevent this war.
Mm.
So obviously, they, as you know, over there, in Britain, there is no impeachment process. So they don't have a written constitution. There is no impeachment process. So those lawyers... different constitutional situation than we are here in America. But here, it certainly is Ramsey Clark's judgment in mind that the most expeditious thing to do is to get that bill of impeachment into the House right away.
As a point of clarification with regard to Bush and the International Criminal Court, even though the U.S. Unsigned that document to be a part of the International Criminal Court, would Bush still be subject to the ruling?
We would have to examine the technical, it doesn't matter subject to the ruling. It's more jurisdictional requirements. Would he kill a citizen of a state that is a party to the ICC statute? We need to establish that. If we could establish that, then I think we could move forward. And it looks like there's going to be a massive bloodbath over there. There are large numbers of voluntary human shields. So I don't think that would be a difficulty, but I have not researched it myself, and I'd have to wait. As I said, Mr. Clark and I are concentrating our efforts right now, not on this initiative, but on getting the bill of impeachment into the House of Representatives right away.
Mm.
And I'm not aware of any group of lawyers right now that are planning an ICC complaint. But I can assure you, if Bush does go to war, this matter will be thoroughly researched and investigated.
Francis Boyle is a professor of international law at the University of Law in Champaign. In part two of our discussion with Boyle tomorrow, we ask the question why this process didn't work in 1991 against George Bush Sr. As Friday's vote at the UN Security Council on a resolution setting a March 17 deadline for Iraq's disarmament draws near, Britain has drafted an alternative proposal. Britain's proposal would require Iraq to comply with six key tests in order to avoid a U.S.-led invasion. These tests include a televised statement by Saddam Hussein in Arabic admitting that he concealed nuclear weapons facilities and that he will no longer seek to obtain weapons of mass destruction. Iraq must also allow unobstructed interviews with key Iraqi scientists outside of Iraq, and it must destroy all mobile chemical and biological weapons facilities. Saddam Hussein has rejected the proposal. U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., John Negroponte, told reporters last night that the only resolution formally under consideration is the U.S. and British resolution submitted on February 24th, calling for a March 17th deadline for Iraq to disarm. He explained the difference between the British-American resolution and the new proposal submitted by British Ambassador Jeremy Greenstock.
Before I comment further on today's initiative, let me remind everyone that, as Resolution 1441 says, Iraq has been and continues to be in material breach of its obligations. And since the passage of Resolution 1441 on November 8th, because of numerous omissions in the Iraqi declaration and repeated violations, we believe Iraq to be in further material breach. That is why on February 24th, our three countries, the United States, the United Kingdom, and Spain, tabled a resolution saying that Iraq had failed to take advantage of its final opportunity. And now we believe the time has come for the Security Council to fulfill its obligations and enforce its resolutions. Iraq must come into compliance immediately and without delay. Let me be clear. Our resolution is still the only resolution on the table, and we have not backed away from the March 17 deadline. This proposal should be considered carefully. And that's what I said in our consultations. I commended it to the consideration of the other member delegations, but that it should be considered in the context of 1441, which requires complete and immediate compliance with all aspects of that resolution. I'll take a few questions. Yes, sir.
Ambassador, what about the British proposals? Have you discussed them, and are you on board with the British?
Yeah, we discussed it.
paragraph 3 of the present resolution?
Well, as I said, the resolution as it was put forward by Secretary of State Jack Straw last Friday is the resolution that is before the council at this moment. No, I'm not. We are not rejecting it. We have in fact agreed, concurred in the submission of this proposal to the council today with our UK colleagues, and we commended it to the consideration of the other delegations and their capitals. But it is at this stage a non-paper. It's an informal proposal, and the whole idea of our discussion and the discussion tomorrow is going to be to see if that proposal on the part that has been put forward by our colleagues from the UK gains any traction with other members of the Security Council. Yes, sir.
What happens, Ambassador, then, if it doesn't gain the so-called traction?
Well, I've said earlier, I repeat, the resolution that is in blue at the moment that is formally before the council is the I think that as long as we are engaged in this effort to mobilize as much council support as possible for our resolution, I'm not going to enter into that kind of speculation. Our focus at the moment is to continue our efforts to try and find a way of rallying sufficient support for our approach within the Security Council. Yes, Colin, back there. Okay, sorry. Yes, sir.
The tone from the British ambassador has been one very much of compromise. With respect, we don't seem to get quite the same sense of compromise from the U.S. position, which will lead to people speculating that there are now differences between the U.S.
and
British.
There are not differences between us. We concurred in the submission of this proposal, but it is a non-paper, and before we embrace it in its entirety, we want to see how other council members feel about it. If they reject it out of hand, or they don't accept it, or they don't think it's a useful avenue to pursue, we are not going to alter the resolution that we currently have before the council. That was the point of my comment.
You
yes, sir.
When do you expect?
We certainly don't expect to vote tomorrow. And other than that, I think we have to really take these things on a day-by-day basis. One last question. Yes, sir.
Yes, you said before that the March 17 deadline is still you're still sticking with the March 17 deadline.
Yes, sir. That's what's in the resolution.
If the British resolution does get traction, are you going to stick with the March 17 deadline?
No. I think the answer to that question would be if there's some traction and if the council starts to coalesce around that approach, then an option available to us is a modest extension, a very, very, very brief extension indeed of that deadline. But I don't want to get pinned down to a specific number of days. Thank you very much. Right.
U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. John Negroponte. Stephen Sawyer, political advisor for Greenpeace International in Amsterdam, is currently in New York monitoring the activities of the U.N. Security Council's deliberations regarding the impending war on Iraq. Greenpeace and the Center for Constitutional Rights have called on the U.N. to use a little-known resolution, 377, to prevent the war in the case of a deadlock in the Security Council. Peacewatch spoke to Sawyer today regarding how U.N. resolution 377 applies to the case of Iraq.
Well, if it would stop the war, that would be fabulous. But it's little used because it only comes into play when the Security Council, due to a deadlock between the permanent members, is unable to come to a conclusion on a matter of international peace and security. Any observer would be forgiven that we are in that position now. There is clearly a deadlock, but negotiations are continuing. The Security Council is still apprised of the matter, and as long as they are, the matters of international peace and security are the sole purview of the Security Council. But should there be a vote, or should the motion be withdrawn with the clear intention that the United States and the United Kingdom would be going to war without UN Security Council sanction, then under Resolution 377, either 9 members of the Security Council or a majority of the members of the General Assembly can call for the General Assembly to meet in emergency session to consider resolutions, making recommendations to members, and trying to figure out a way forward. none of this will come into play until and unless there is a vote or until the motion is withdrawn. At that point, we're hoping, and we know that members are discussing this as we speak, we hope that they will call for such a resolution and put forward a resolution basically condemning any action without Security Council sanction as being in direct violation of the UN Charter, Article 2.4. And that would set up the situation clearly, which has been our contention all along, that a preventive war authorized by the Security Council is in fact illegal under a number of international statutes, but most importantly in direct contravention of the UN Charter. And we feel that that's just unacceptable, and we are quite certain that the vast majority of the members of the UN General Assembly would agree. So what you'd end up with is a vote by all of the members of the United Nations, all 191 of them, laying their cards on the table of this question of the appropriate means to ensure compliance with Resolution 1441, Resolution 1284, and the other Security Council resolutions relating to Iraqi disarmament. Mm-hmm. And whether or not that would persuade the Bush administration and Tony Blair's administration, that's impossible to tell.
And so would it just be a matter of persuading them? Does this have any kind of authority whatsoever other than just going on record?
It doesn't have legal authority in the same way that a Security Council resolution would, but it would clearly express the will of the international community. And the administration is going to great lengths to demonstrate that they really have the support of most of the world, and it's only the French that are being difficult, and nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, we've talked to about 50 delegations in the last 3 days, and we've watched demonstrations and listened to statements from countries all around the world. The United States really has very, very, very little support in this notion.
Mm-hmm. Now, would something like this give some of the countries on the Security Council almost an opportunity to vote to abstain or to side with the U.S. if they know that this effort is underway for this broader vote?
I don't think it's going to sway them, because they're all very much under the huge international spotlight. Most of the countries in the middle six, so to speak, are faced with a quandary between enormous diplomatic and economic and political pressure being exercised by the United States and the United Kingdom on the one hand, and overwhelming domestic political opposition to a war at home.
Okay. The reports that I read said that France has said whatever happens, they would veto any resolution that included a use of force.
Automatic use of force.
Yes.
Because, I mean, or a call for an authorization of force by the Security Council at this time. Nobody's put forward such a resolution. The British resolution, British-sponsored resolution, that is the only one that's really on the table at the moment, is, in fact, doesn't have an authorization of force contained within it. What they would then argue, of course, would be that at the conclusion of this one-week timetable or something, then they would be able to decide whether or not compliance had been reached, and would use that as an automatic trigger. And that is what the French and the Russians and the Chinese and most of the, and certainly the Germans and the Syrians, and we've heard Mexico and Chile speak against that as well.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of thing that they're objecting to. Now, if there were a resolution, a compromise resolution, which did have clear timetables in it, along the lines that were laid out in the French memorandum a couple of weeks ago, or, in fact, as Chief Weapons Inspector Hans Blix has said that he will be presenting to the Security Council either tomorrow or Monday, pursuant to Resolution 1284, which is the process that was supposed to have been followed, then I wouldn't be surprised if you would find French, German, Russian, Chinese support for something like that.
How much support has this resolution received thus far? We know that it's been used in the past, and can you just sort of articulate those instances for us?
Well, the first instance when it was used, I mean, it was originally established in 1950, largely at the instigation of the United States over the conflict on the Korean Peninsula, and when they were worried about Russian vetoes to Security Council measures. It wasn't used in that instance. The first time it was used was in 1956 during the Suez Crisis, when Britain and France invaded Suez. A Security Council resolution calling on them to withdraw, put forward by the United States, was in fact vetoed by both Russia and France. And then the General Assembly convened an emergency session, passed resolutions calling on France and Britain to withdraw from Suez, and used that as a springboard for a number of other, a great deal of diplomatic and political pressure. And in fact, France and Britain did withdraw within a week.
So it did work.
It did work.
Why do you think it worked in 1956 in the event of the Suez Canal with Britain and France, and it did not work in the case of the Soviet Union invading Hungary?
Well, for different reasons. I mean, in the relation to the Suez crisis, I mean, the British and the French made a fairly serious political miscalculation, it seems to me, in terms of how, you know, the sort of victors of World War II could go and strut their stuff and protect their economic interests in another part of the world, and they would expect to get backing from the rest of the major powers and indeed the UN as a whole. That didn't turn out to be the case. In the Soviet situation with Hungary, of course, you had the whole balance of power of the Cold War and the United States and Russia, no doubt, evaluating the calculus, realized that it was not risking an exchange of thermonuclear weapons or a major nuclear conflagration over this incident. And in the end, the U.S. and the other Western powers that were opposed to the invasion of Hungary backed off.
So they weren't willing to take on a worldwide, large-scale, possibly nuclear war for the benefit of Hungary is basically
what it turned out. I think that would be the Cold War kind of calculus that would have been operating in that circumstance. But in the current situation, it's obviously very, very different. Nobody outside of the White House or the Pentagon really believes that Iraq presents a direct threat to the United States of the kind envisaged in the United Nations Charter, which would provide a legal basis for a war. And, you know, it is a political move by the United States, the end of a long period of the establishment of what's now known as the Bush Doctrine, which basically where the United States government arrogates itself the rights and powers of, in fact, the Security Council and the entire international legal framework. It's a very worrying development. It's something that we've seen across the board in multilateral relations, mm-hmm. basically ever since Rio de Janeiro in 1992, since the Earth Summit, where the U.S. has gradually withdrawn from multilateral agreement after multilateral agreement, mm-hmm. and trying to project American political and trade interests basically on the back of unchallenged military superiority.
So, but now, in this case, in order for this resolution 377 to work, other nations in the world would have to be prepared to confront the U.S. and Britain over this issue?
Not confront them militarily, one doesn't presume, but confront them politically, yes, and I think that's what's happening across the street at the U.N. right now. You know, but the other thing is, I mean, nobody disagrees that I've heard, with the possible exception of Syria or maybe one or two other countries, with the goal of ensuring that the Iraqi government complies with the resolutions and eliminates whatever weapons of mass destruction and proscribed weapons that it currently has in its arsenal. Everyone agrees on that. The debate is over whether you do it, exhaust all means to do it without loss of civilian life, without killing tens or hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, and without creating millions of refugees, before that last option is finally brought to the table to be considered. And that's what we're facing at present. That's the choice. The world can continue, and there's no question that the military pressure that has been brought by the U.S. and others have moved the process along. So if George Bush were to turn around 3 weeks from now, or a month from now, and say, oh, this was just a strategy to get them to comply, he will be judged a great hero and a masterful set of brinksmanship. I'm afraid, and I don't think anybody else believes, that that's what he's really doing. Because all of this talk of regime change is totally outside the framework of the United Nations and outside the frame of international law. If the goal, as Resolution 1441 says, and as the other relevant resolutions say, is in fact the elimination of the weapons of mass destruction and other proscribed weapons from Iraq, then you'd have everyone's agreement. As soon as you start talking about regime change, then that's beyond the pale of the international legal framework.
Stephen Sawyer, political advisor for Greenpeace. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.